WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. I'm Paul Nosh, and I'm the host of Touchstones. Today we're going to be discussing Islam, and specifically the form of Islam that is not much discussed in the media these days, or and not necessarily well understood, but may be an anecdote to the Islamicist terrorism that people unfortunately identify with Islam. And our guest today is Stephen Schwartz. Stephen, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Glad to be on the show.
All right. I'm happy you're here. And Stephen Schwartz is the executive director of a Washington think tank called the Center for Islamic Pluralism, which I understand is a more than a Washington think tank, but is actually in all over the world as a way of trying to give a political voice to moderate Muslims. And what is a moderate Muslim, Stephen?
Well, we define a moderate Muslim as a mainstream Muslim who accepts the mainstream theology that evolved in Islam, basically beginning, it began to evolve in its more recent form in the 13th century, and it's a form of Islam that is not not oriented toward conquering the world. It's not oriented toward any form of aggression toward other religions. It's defined in Islamic theology. It defines Islam in the theological writings as neither too convinced nor too doubting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically the ordinary of Islam of roughly a billion people. It's a normal religion which people practice the way people practice other religions. It's not fundamentalist. It's not extreme. It's not violent. It doesn't have a deep, aggressive attitude towards other religions. It's simply a normal religion, comparable with Catholicism or Judaism or Buddhism.
Right, and it's probably the Islam that's followed by the majority of people who confess to be Muslims.
Yes, actually it is. It's aside from the representatives of the Saudi state and the Iranian state and the Sudanese state, which are radical Islamic states, it's the Islam of roughly a billion people around the world. And there are also problems with the Islam of in the Islamic communities of Britain and the United States, especially in terms of non-Muslim societies. But aside from the Islamist states and the diaspora communities that are heavily influenced by radical Islam, moderate Islam represents the viewpoint of the overwhelming majority.
Right.
Which is why we're having this conversation instead of living in a cave somewhere. If 1 billion Muslims were all committed to violent, aggressive attitudes towards the rest of the world, the clash of civilizations would be much more serious and much more extensive, and it would be life would be intolerable, really.
But you know, this form of radical Islam, I mean, there's always been fundamentalist aspects within Islam, and historically, as in most religions, there's always aspect of the religion that tends to be extremist or literalist in some form. But this particular style of radical Islam that emerged within the 20th century is actually kind of unique in a way. What would you say about that?
Well, radical Islam is a new development. It's not traditional. It's not conservative. Radical Islam gets labeled with these politically correct labels like being traditional, radical, conservative, and so forth. But it isn't traditional. It isn't conservative. It's radical. It's extremist. And Islamist extremism is a new phenomenon in Islam. It's a phenomenon that started roughly 250 years ago and is based on the crisis of the Islamic empires as they came into conflict with the Western colonial expansion, and as they began to experience weakness and difficulty in maintaining themselves in the face of the advance of Western colonialism. Radical Islam emerged as a response to Western colonialism. In some cases, like that of Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, abetted by Western colonialism. But it's a form of Islam responding to a crisis in Islam. It's responding to a crisis in the Islamic societies. I shouldn't say a crisis in the religion of Islam, but a crisis in the Islamic societies. And the first, and really the original model for this is Wahhabism in Arabia,
mm-hmm.
which emerged as a what I call a reactionary utopian attack on the Islam of the Ottoman Empire, which theologically and socially was a very open-minded and pluralistic Islam. It also attacked the Islam of Persia, which was Shia and mystical.
Right. Now, just for people who know nothing of Islam, there's two major schools in Islam. There's a there's the Sunni school, which you can define for us, and the Shia school. How would you see those two different trends?
Well, if you take a class at a university, they'll explain it to you that in terms of the succession of authority from the Prophet Muhammad, and that the Shias favored the governance of the Islamic community or Ummah should be in the hands of certain direct descendants from the Prophet through the Prophet's son-in-law, Ali, Imam Ali. They were basically defeated. Ali was assassinated, and the Prophet's grandson, Hussein, was assassinated. They were defeated by a group that were not derived from the family of the Prophet, but were derived from a successor of the Prophet, and are known as the Umayyads. And the Umayyads formed the predecessors of the Sunnis, and the followers of Ali and Hussein formed the predecessors of the Shias. Now, if you take a sort of Western prescriptive course on this topic,
mm-hmm.
they will stress that it's to them, it's a quarrel over the succession of the Prophet. But the succession of the Prophet took place 1,300 years ago, and it's certainly among Shias these issues continue to be discussed. But there are really other issues that define the difference between Sunnism and Shiism. In my mind, the biggest difference is that the Sunnis continued the tradition of conforming to the established authority. The Umayyads had established an authority, and the Sunnis conformed to that authority. They accepted that authority.
Right.
And the Sunnis believe that a Muslim should accept a tyrannical leader, even if the tyrannical leader is oppressive, and that the Muslims should pray for the tyrannical leader to find right guidance. Whereas the Shias, beginning with Hussein, who was killed, who was martyred,
mm-hmm.
believe that it's correct to rebel in the name of justice and to struggle and to fight for justice within the Islamic Ummah. So the real essential difference is the difference between conformism and rebellion,
mm-hmm.
Conformism and the legitimization of rebellion. What also flows from that, however, there's also the fact that that Umayyad and Sunni Islam, with its conformist character, in my view, has also lost its intellectual edge. Sunni Muslims tend not to read non-Muslim works. They don't read philosophy. They become Sufis, but they don't engage with Sufism in the same profound theosophical way that Shias do.
Mm-hmm.
Shias read philosophy. They read Greek philosophy. They read Western philosophy. They consider philosophy to be an intrinsic part of the Islamic intellect, and their Sufism is of a much more a much deeper and more serious character in a certain way.
Well, I mean, in some ways, though, at least historically, it seems that the Shias also were more readily accepted in the Persian thing and took on the Persian heritage of learning and style of poetry and music and other types of things.
Well, this is somewhat deceptive, actually, because Shiism didn't become the state religion of Persia until only 300 years ago with the rise of the Safavid Empire. But the Sufis had certainly partaken of the Eastern wisdom represented by the Zoroastrians, the Hindus, to some extent the Buddhists, and even the Chinese religions. And the Persian Empire, the Persian culture sphere, advanced in an area geographically towards the east, towards China, in a way that did give the Shias more access and more, more capacity to interact with the existing traditions of Eastern wisdom. But this, the Persian affinity for Shiism is not the same as the Persian affinity for Eastern wisdom. The Persian affinity for Shiism has more to do with the politics of the Islamic empires in the period after the in the period when the Renaissance was taking place in Europe. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, if we look at the Islamic cultures today, some of the greatest Sufi classics are Persian. Not all of them. Some of them are also Turkish, and some of them are definitely from the early period Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
But in Persia, certain Sufis are considered to be representatives of the greatest achievements of Persian literature. For example, Jalaluddin Rumi and others. And
right.
So there is this sense of an association of Shiism and Persian culture and Sufism as all kind of being bundled together. But it's actually somewhat misleading, in my view.
Well, actually, at the very opening of your book, you mentioned something that some people may remember vaguely. Back in May of 2007, there was a major bomb which struck the mosque of Sheikh Abdul Qadir Jilani.
Yeah, Abdul Qadir Jilani, the Jilani Shrine in Iraq.
Now I know from my readings, and we're actually, the point of this conversation, folks, is we are discussing Sufism, which is the mystical forms of Islam that are both Sunni and Shia.
That's right,
and Jilani is really considered one of the great exemplars of Sufism from a Sunni point of view, and even to this day, his writings are considered authoritative, and there are probably several Sufi orders that count him amongst their predecessors.
That's quite true. Jilani is the great symbolic figure of Sunni Sufism.
So, the bombing of his tomb is a pretty horrendous act. When you think about it,
the bombing of the Jilani Shrine was one of the worst acts of terrorism in the Iraq War. In terms of the symbolism and the cultural devastation, and cultural vandalism.
Yeah. Which, and as you say here, that it wasn't the Shias doing this. The Shias respect the saints, for the most part, most Sunni saints, or at least remain mute on the topic. Rather, it was done by a form of Islamist Wahhabi terrorist that probably emerges out of Saudi Arabia.
Well, what has happened in Iraq is what I call the second invasion of Iraq, because there was the American invasion of Iraq, but then there was the Saudi invasion of Iraq. And what that was, which was not, is still not clearly understood in the United States, I would say is not really very well understood in the West, is that the terrorism, the Islamist terrorism that emerged in Iraq, and which is always described in Western media as insurgency, is not insurgency in the classic sense. It's not a reaction of Iraqis to the American invasion. It's a second invasion. It's an invasion of Iraq financed by and recruited in Saudi Arabia by the ultra-fundamentalist Wahhabi sect of Sunni Islam, who basically invaded Iraq. In fact, they were fighting in Iraq before the United States intervened. They were fighting in Iraq when the United States intervened. And their mission, their cause, is to kill Shias and to kill Sufis and to kill Sunnis who don't follow the Wahhabi interpretation of Islam. And they have conducted or led most of the terrorist activity in Iraq since the American intervention.
And by the terrorist activity, you're talking about the suicide bombings that are so prevalent and a lot of the roadside.
Right, suicide bombings, roadside IEDs, attacks, fighting with the coalition forces in cities like Fallujah. Almost all of this was actually led by Saudis. It was not led by Iraqis. It didn't represent an Iraqi patriotic insurgency against the presence of Americans in
Iraq. But there has been some noise that's been made in the Western media about the Shia and Iranian involvement with the creation of this.
Yeah, there's also unquestionably Shia and radical Iranian involvement with forms of militants and forms of political violence and combat in Iraq, but the comparative level of Shia violence in Iraq is lower than that of Sunni violence or Wahhabi violence. And by and large, the Shias have been involved in what could better be described as communal fighting, that is, rivalry between Shias and Sunnis over control of particular areas of Iraq, whereas the Wahhabis have been involved in a general campaign against non-Wahhabi Muslims in Iraq.
Well, one of the interesting developments that took place starting, I guess, in Fallujah was the disavowal of the Sunni insurgents there against the Wahhabis.
Well, it was visible actually fairly early that with the Wahhabi invasion of Iraq, the insurgents in Iraq, the Sunni combatants in Iraq who were fighting against the coalition forces and fighting against the Shia majority political authority in Iraq, had to make a choice, because when the Wahhabis came into Iraq from Saudi Arabia and brought with them all of their typical Wahhabi depredations, which involved the banning of music, the banning of women going out in public without full covering, the banning of Sufi practices like prayer at shrines, which the Wahhabis really hate.
Right. Oh, particularly, this is a loud prayer?
They don't allow any prayer at shrines at all.
Uh-huh.
They don't want anybody to go pray at shrines.
Yeah.
They don't even want shrines to exist.
So that's why they're blowing them up.
Right, that's why they blow them up. And when a lot of the Iraqi combatants who were fighting against the coalition or fighting against the Shia majority government discovered that the alternative was either the coalition and Shia majority government on one side or the Wahhabis on the other, who were coming into places like Fallujah and executing women in the street for not covering themselves and then posting announcements bragging about it, the Iraqi combatants decided it was better to side with the U.S.-led coalition and the Shia-majority government than to allow the Wahhabis to take control, because basically Iraqi people don't like Wahhabis.
Mm-hmm.
This was also visible from the beginning. In the Saudi media, it was reported that Saudis who had gone to fight in Iraq came back and were very disillusioned with the situation. They said that they would go up to Iraq and the people would say, "We don't want you here. Go back to where you come from. We don't want you or your view of Islam or your terrorism here." And so that was something that was visible from the beginning.
Well, it's a shame though that it wasn't made more visible in terms of U.S. policy there or whatever in terms of decreasing the violence. But fighting a war in hindsight is deceptive, if anything. And let's assume now we're dealing with the end game. Somehow American troops are counting down, are becoming less involved and less involved in Iraqi society. Iraqi society is becoming self-governing. And in varying degrees, what do you see the role of Sufism, mystical Islam, as it will become reconstituted within an Iraqi society? What do you think would be based on the traditions that are available to the people there? How do you see that working?
Well, the Shia majority certainly is hospitable to Sufism and considers Sufism an intrinsic and necessary part of Islam. So with a Shia majority government, one can expect that there will be a natural growth of interest and support for Sufism. Secondly, the Kurdistan political leadership is entirely made up of Sufis, fairly distinguished Sunni Sufis.
Mm-hmm. Which Sufi orders?
They're Naqshbandis.
Naqshbandis.
A few Qadiris, but basically Naqshbandis, which is problematical because, as I say, point out in my book, the Naqshbandis have essentially a somewhat fundamentalist character. But, the Kurdistan political leadership are overwhelmingly Naqshbandis.
Hmm.
So Sufism has a future in Kurdistan. And since Sufism really began in Iraq, Sufism is always been popular among the Arab Sunnis in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason that once Iraq is stabilized with a real local government that's able to exercise power in the country, that it won't become, in effect, one of the major countries for Sufi activity,
yeah,
comparable to Morocco or Indonesia.
But one of the things that Sufism does is it humanizes a religion in a way. It makes hitting some stereotypes here. You know, the religion is less legalistic and becomes more oriented to love, as might be said by the things. You know, It brings a more gentle face.
This aspect of Islam always existed, but Sufism is the embodiment of it, and Sufism was always part of it. It's only when Islam went into crisis that a strong critical stream against Sufism emerged, mainly in the 18th and 19th centuries, that associated Sufism either with borrowing from other religions, which the fundamentalists claimed was not permitted, or claimed it was a dilution of Islam, or, as I often hear, that it's not part of Islam and it comes from outside of Islam. I wouldn't say that it's a question of a dialectic in which Sufism softens the hardness of Islam. I would just say that Sufism was always there in Islam and was a powerful force in Islam, but as Islam went into crisis and fundamentalist criticism of Sufism and mysticism came to the forefront, in that the fundamentalists were offering an explanation for why the Islamic empires and the Islamic Ummah had become weakened, and part of one of the foundations of their criticism was the argument that Sufism had diluted Islam by its borrowings from other religions, its friendship with other religions, and its general emphasis on internal cultivation, contemplation, meditation, rather than an emphasis on external practice.
Right. You know, if we shift over to Iran, how do you see Sufism affecting political change in Iran? Because in some ways, you know, the Anatollahs, which is a traditional form of leadership within Iranian religious authority, got politicized a lot in a lot of ways as part of in resistance to the Shah, and you know, the which is where we got the Ayatollah, the rule of the Ayatollahs at this point. But apparently the Ayatollahs are not in complete unity with each other in Iran, and that there's a politicized you know, ruling class of Ayatollahs in Iran, and there's also Ayatollahs that are critical of this secular movement within the hierarchy. How does Sufism play out in Iran to the degree that you're familiar with that?
Well, I am actually pretty familiar with it. So a person somewhat distantly associated with the Center of Islamic for Islamic Pluralism was just sentenced to a 12-year prison sentence in Iran. And I've been following the situation very closely. Although it's very badly reported in the West, Iran is a mess. Iran politically is a mess, and it's in crisis. The clerical regime of the Shia Ayatollahs in Iran was never represented a mainstream theological view in Shiism or in Islam. In Islam, clerics are not supposed to rule. Clerics are supposed to advise the rulers. And throughout Islamic history, with a very few exceptions, the rulers of the society were military men, and now we have the phenomenon of political rulership. But the clerics, the religious leaders, did not exercise
direct power.
And the idea of an Islamic theocracy, or theocratic Islam, is a new idea both in Sunnism and in Shiism. Now, what has happened is that the in the period of the Shah, because of the difficulties in the society created by the Shah's rule, Iranian Shiism, which had previously been politically quietistic, Iranian Shiism previously held to the position that religion could not play a role in the rulership of the society until the return of the 12th Shia Imam, because nobody would have the level of virtue required to rule over society that would be found in the 12th Imam, who's called the Hidden Imam.
Mm-hmm.
But the group of Ayatollahs and clerics around Khomeini and Ayatollah Beheshti and several others developed a fairly interesting and subtle new interpretation, which was they said that although no ruler had emerged, or no individual had emerged, or was expected to immediately emerge, who would have the virtue of the 12th Imam, that they had to prepare the society for the coming of the 12th Imam by improving the level of social responsibility and social welfare, and by overthrowing the tyranny of the Shah. This was the idea of Islamic revolution. Now, revolution has never been a popular idea in Islam. In fact, Islam teaches that dissension and conflict, fitna, is worse than unbelief. But the Iranian Shia clerics developed this theory, this doctrine under the leadership of Khomeini, which said that it was necessary to prepare the society for the coming of the Imam. It was a kind of a utopian social vision. It was adopted by these clerics, who were clerics in opposition, and they established the clerical rulership of the Ayatollahs. The problem is that the scheme did not work. It manifestly has not worked.
Uh-huh.
Now we have 30 years have gone by since 1978, and a whole new generation has emerged that never knew the rulership of the Shah. And they are the majority in the country.
Yeah.
And also, as you point out, there's immense division within the ruling caste of Ayatollahs. There are reformist Ayatollahs. There are reactionary Ayatollahs. There are traditionalist Ayatollahs. And then there are the political Ayatollahs. And there's great dissatisfaction with the regime as it presently exists. Most people are quite discontented with the regime as it presently exists. Many people are very discontented with the fact that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, this essentially stupid and incompetent political dictator, has put Iran in the situation of being, it's put Iran in a worse situation than it was before. Bush described Iran as part of the axis of evil, but Ahmadinejad really made it part of the axis of evil.
He took on the mantle as an
became a fulfilled prophecy in that Ahmadinejad increased the negative image of Iran in the view of world opinion. So now you have really a tremendously unstable situation. Westerners don't really grasp this. Westerners look at the regime and they think everybody supports Ahmadinejad, that everybody is crazy. Now, Ahmadinejad has tried to revive the ideology of the coming of the 12th Imam in order to revive the ideology of the revolution. The bottom line here, though, about Sufism is so deeply implanted and so widely established in Iranian culture that as the Iranian people and Iranian society try to find a way out of the dead end that's been created by the clerical dictatorship, it's inevitable that Sufism will play a major role in the restoration and development of civil society.
I think the other thing that we might want to stress is that probably for the most part is that Iran has a strong civil society, which is not the case or was not the case with Iraq because of the depredations.
Yes, Iran does have a strong civil society, but that civil society has been curbed and limited by the clerical dictatorship.
Right.
And that civil society is trying to break through the limitations imposed on by the clerical dictatorship.
I'd also assume that for the most part, most of Iran is relatively peaceful in the sense that there isn't bombings going on. There isn't the kind of anarchy that one has in Iraq.
Well, there's been a Wahhabi insurgency or uprising among the Arabs in the Arab part of Iran. And
which part is that?
There's an Arab area in southwest Iran,
mm-hmm.
in which there's been Arabistan, it's called, and there's been Wahhabi terrorism has recently emerged there.
Yeah, well, that and of course that destabilizes the civil society more than anything else, which is
Well, it's actually it's all it's really done is made the Iranian people hate Wahhabis more.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, there's a difference between. Iraq is a post-war society.
It's possible that Wahhabism with its incendiary version, its militancy, which is so incendiary and so hateful, will extinguish itself. It can't be sustained with that. You can't sustain.
No, but it hasn't reached the state of decadence that Soviet communism reached. It's Wahhabism is still a volatile force. Nobody should make any mistake about that.
It took a long time.
Power in Saudi Arabia will remain a volatile force.
It took a long time for the volatility of the Soviet force to.
Well, it wasn't such a long time in historical terms because it's really only 70 years, because Wahhabism has been around for 250 years.
Yeah.
But Wahhabism will still be a threat even if it's removed from its authority over religious life in Saudi Arabia. But the your point about the difference between Iran and Iraq is, of course, I mean, Iraq is a post-war society in which a dictatorship was removed and
right. All
controls were removed, and then tremendous rivalries broke out between the different communities, and then there was this Wahhabi invasion from Saudi Arabia. Iran is just a more tranquil society. I mean, Iran is a more effective... Iran is still a dictatorship. Iran is a clerical dictatorship, and it's a dictatorship that's in crisis, but the crisis has not yet reached the point of outbreaks of violence or sustained conflict within the country.
Do you think that's going to be almost a necessary possibility in terms of the?
No.
I guess it really depends on.
I don't think political violence is a necessity in any country. I think that what we have after the death of Franco and the Spanish transition to democracy,
uh-huh.
And then we look at a series of transitions to democracy that took place sometimes in the wake of political violent revolutions. But to me, the two defining or three defining moments were the peaceful political transition to democracy in Spain after the death of Franco,
mm-hmm.
followed by the people power revolution in the Philippines, and then followed by the peaceful transition away from the military dictatorship in Indonesia, which is the world's largest Muslim country. And the list of countries that have had peaceful transitions away from dictatorship without political violence is extremely long. Most Americans and Americans of the left don't seem to have assimilated the fact that, for example, the Pinochet government in Chile was not overthrown. It
mm-hmm.
there was a peaceful transition away from Pinochet's dictatorship. There was a peaceful transformation, a peaceful transition away from the one-party state of the PRI in Mexico. Even, in fact, the end of Sandinismo in Nicaragua was essentially a peaceful process. You have the end of the military dictatorship in South Korea, the end of the one-party state in Taiwan. The fact is that violent revolutionary means are no longer necessary.
Well,
to get rid of dictatorship.
The other thing I think that all of these peaceful revolutions seem to also show is the importance of civil society, because that's the class that sustains and demands the consistency for reform.
Well, there's a combination in all of these countries of the rise of the middle class, the rise of civil society, but I think there's also something that's not very well understood, is that religion does play a positive role in almost all of these situations. In Mexico, in Nicaragua, the Catholic Church, and the Philippines, of course,
mm-hmm.
the Catholic Church played a crucial role. In Poland, in the transition away from Soviet communism, the church obviously played
right.
an outstanding role. The church played a similar role in Hungary. The church plays, and then I think that moderate Islam can play a similar role. It played a similar role in Indonesia, and that moderate Islam will play a similar role in countries like Saudi and Saudi Arabia, Iran, and even possibly Egypt.
And
Pakistan, I'm not sure of.
Yeah, let's switch gears a little bit here. I want to tell everybody you're listening to Touchstones. I'm your host, Paul Nagy. We're talking to Stephen Schwartz, who has written a new book, which is available in all your major bookstores. It's called The Other Islam, Sufism and the Road to Global Harmony. Sufism is the mystical aspect of Islam. And we have been talking about the nature of Islam and the nature of religious reform, particularly as Sufism reached it on an international basis. We were talking about Iraq and Iran, and then also Stephen mentioned some of the other aspects of peaceful sort of democratic revolutions that evolving over time. That the non necessity of revolutionary reform. I would like to go briefly to discuss the nature of Islam as it is emerging in America, particularly the United States. But we can draw a broader net if you want to. Because it's kind of unique here in a way, is that one, we have there was almost no evidence of Islam in the famous 1893 World Parliament of Religions, in which the only person who stood up for Islam was a theosophist who was a convert to Islam. I think his name was Weber or something like that, And then even as late as the 1950s, there was not a great deal of Islamic presence in the United States that I know about. You can correct me if you'd like. And then we have the rise of Islam as part of the African American liberation movements, early forms of them, which go back, I guess, to the 1920s or so. which is an interesting emergence of Islam for African Americans. And I'd like to be if you could address some of the aspects of Islam among African Americans as it's evolving. And of course, now with the change in immigration patterns, there are a great deal of immigré Muslims in the United States from all over the world, from Islamic cultures, and that they represent quite a bit of what's going on in America today. But again, with some of the same kinds of problems that we see in and they, in other words, they come with difficulties and even of asserting what their values are. So you want to give a little characterization of American Islam?
Well, there was an interest in Islam and in Sufism in particular among the Transcendentalists prior to the 1893 World Parliament of Religions. But it's true, there was really almost no Islamic presence in the United States in terms of authentic Islam, in terms of mainstream Islam, until the 1980s. The situation with the African-American community is very complicated and has to do with the history of social institutions within the African-American community, and that is that at the beginning of the 20th century, a phenomenon emerged, which I call the adoption of Islamic signifiers, Islamic cultural signifiers by African Americans who did not, in fact, become Muslims but adopted Islamic terms, terminology, and some Islamic conceptions and grafted them onto forms of African American nationalism. The first example of this is something that's still around today, which is called the Moorish Science Temple. What these really were offshoots of African-American forms of Freemasonry. Now, when I say that now, having been corrected on this by a prominent Freemason here in the United States, I have to point out I'm not saying anything negative about Freemasonry. Freemasons can do whatever they want as far as I'm concerned. I'm not concerned about Freemasonry, but what you had with Moorish Science Temple, and then what you have with the Nation of Islam in the form of Elijah Muhammad, and then later temporarily under Malcolm X, and then under Louis Farrakhan, these are not really Islamic movements at all. I mean, first of all, there's no mosque in the world that has a color standard for who walks into it.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, The Elijah Muhammad movement and the Farrakhan movement preach that this individual named Elijah, who calls himself Elijah Muhammad, who's born Elijah Poole in Georgia, and his predecessor, this strange fellow from New Zealand, Wallace Ford, were prophets. And Islam teaches that Muhammad was the last prophet. So if you come along and you say that prophets emerged in the United States in the 1920s and 30s, this is not only not an Islamic view, this is an anti-Islamic view. So they adopted Islamic cultural signifiers, saying salam alaikum to each other, calling their meeting places mosques, and borrowing some textual references and terminology from Islam. But this is not Islam. It's something... it's more a kind of a radical form of black Freemasonry. Now, with the crisis with the assassination of Malcolm X in the middle 1960s, and the crisis in the Nation of Islam movement, there was a development by a fairly considerable number of African Americans in the direction of mainstream Islam or normative Islam. But in my view, that development failed. Normative Islam really never took hold among African Americans in the way the Nation of Islam did, because normative Islam, as Malcolm X observed when he made the Hajj to Mecca, normative Islam could not easily be subsumed into black nationalism, because normative Islam is universalist and is not, except for Wahhabism, which is based on Arab supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
Normative Islam is not based on nationalism or the supremacy of a particular cultural or ethnic group. As I now, as I say, there is this Arabocentric Islam, and there's this Saudi Wahhabi supremacism based on the status of the Saudis. But these are really deviations in the history of Islam, and you can't really subsume, you can't really merge black nationalism and normative Islam. And so I think normative Islam has failed among African Americans. It's failed to really develop a strong community.
But that really hasn't been the case with Wahhabism, at least in terms of their trying to create their brand of Islam.
Well, Wahhabism has a certain hold among African Americans who become Muslims. Yes, it mm-hmm. does. But it doesn't. The domination of Wahhabism in the United States is not based on influence among African Americans. It's based on the change in the demographic involving immigrants, and which you pointed out. And that has to do with the fact that in the 1980s, with the changes in the immigration laws and changes in the influx of especially Pakistani, only secondarily Arab, but mainly Pakistani immigrants to the United States,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden, mainstream, long-established normative Islam had a fairly significant presence in the United States for the first time. And the plurality of the Muslims, of the born Muslims living in America, is Pakistani. And Pakistani Islam is also in crisis and is deeply troubled, deeply divided by jihadist influence.
But it's a different, it has a different history than Wahhabism, as we're talking about.
Not
right?
Very different. No, uh-huh. Not really. What okay. you had is a situation where Pakistani jihad against India over Kashmir, and then Pakistani involvement in the struggle of the Afghans against the Russians,
mm-hmm.
Plus the rise in India before the British left India, of the fundamentalist Sunni movement led by a man named Maududi. The combination of these three things, Maududism, the jihad against India over Kashmir, and the struggle against the Russians over the Afghanistan, combined with Saudi money, combined with American diplomatic ignorance of the situation, gave fundamentalism an extremely powerful foothold in Pakistan, and Pakistan's army and intelligence service and government are now deeply infiltrated by Wahhabis and Deobandis, who are an Indian sect that are fundamentalists in the same way the Wahhabis are, but originally were not violent, but in their Pakistani form, they were basically picked up by the Saudis and transformed into something closer to Wahhabism. So Pakistan today is basically a crisis state. It's approaching being a failed state. In the Center for Islamic Pluralism, we believe that the Taliban are attempting to invade and even conquer Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Pakistan is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the trustworthy ally of the West that it's been portrayed as.
Right.
Radical Islam is too deeply entrenched in the government there now. The point being that the plurality of born Muslims in the United States are Pakistanis. And this has kind of been ignored. It's ignored by the so-called terror experts. It's ignored by the academics. It's ignored by the media. In the United States, Islam has this image of being the Arab religion, and radical Islam has this image of being mainly a reflection of Saudi Wahhabism, and certainly in terms of its financing, radical Islam is rests on Saudi Wahhabism. But in my view, there's a triangulation in which there's Saudi money, Pakistani functionaries and followers and foot soldiers, and then there's some of the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood from North Africa,
mm-hmm.
Egypt especially, also plays into this. But the real issue here is that American Islam is intellectually the most empty Islam in the world. I mean, there is more intellectual debate, discussion, controversy, development in Iran or in Saudi Arabia or in Sudan than there is in the mosques in the United States. American Islam is totally conformist. It's totally ideologized. The Wahhabis, the Pakistani jihadists, are in the saddle in American Islam. American Islam does not produce intellectuals. It does not produce religious thinkers. It does not produce very many serious Sufis. And furthermore, another problem in this, an enormous problem in this, is that the American Academy has adopted an apologetical attitude about radical Islam, in that the Middle Eastern Studies departments of the major universities basically teach that Wahhabi Islam, Arab Islam, Arabocentric Islam, jihadist Islam is the mainstream.
In other words, it's normative.
Yeah, that it's normative. They are hostile to Israel in a way that leads them to sustain this argument that, that radical Islam is normative Islam. They are, and they suppress, really, they suppress scholarship. I mean, there was essentially no scholarship on Wahhabism before 9/11. In my book, my first major book on Islam, The Two Faces of Islam, was the first expose of Wahhabism ever produced in the United States, ever published in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the products of the American Middle Eastern Studies Academy, there's very little on Sufism, very little on Shiism, very little on Wahhabism, but there's a vast amount cataloging for the millionth time the grievances of the Palestinians, the crank, quack, the pseudo intellectual meanderings of Edward Said, and all of this other basically parasitical pseudo-intellectual stuff that has had a tremendously negative impact on American Islam, because American Islam is divided either by, is defined either by radical clerics or by academic apologists for radicalism or by the Arab or Wahhabi lobbies. This is a very bad situation for Islam. It's really a unique situation. This is the only country in the world where this is true.
Well, at the center of Islamic pluralism, what would you say the moderate view of Muslims would be, particularly given the issue of Palestine? I would assume they're probably sympathetic to the Palestinians, if not if actually wanting a state, at least in having a better, less besieged life.
Well, everybody in the world sympathizes, including most people in Israel, sympathize at some point with the Palestinians. I mean, Israel is not a Nazi state. Israel is not a state where everybody just wants to kill Palestinians or wants to get rid of Palestinians. Most Israelis come from a liberal or left-wing political background and would like very much to find a solution to this problem. I would say most Muslims and most people in the world feel that the Palestinians are in a very difficult situation. They suffer a lot. They, their situation is not a positive or fulfilling one for them. Israel does not bear exclusive responsibility for this. The United Nations bears a lot of responsibility for this, for basically keeping the Palestinians in a refugee status.
Well,
other Arab states bear a lot of responsibility
for the same reason,
not helping the Palestinians.
By refusing Palestinians the possibility of citizenship in any other state.
Yeah, this the other Arab states do this. What we take done in the Center for Islamic Pluralism, which is somewhat controversial, is we don't take a position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, this is for the Israelis and the Palestinians to work out for themselves. What we do is we attempt to focus attention on the group in the whole complex picture that is the most interesting and the most neglected, which is that of people who are known as Israeli Arabs or Israeli Muslims. That is,
right.
Arab Muslims living in Israel who participate in the institutions of Israeli society.
Right.
Most people in the West, for example, don't know that Israel has Sharia courts for Muslims.
Right.
Well, there's 1.2 million Israeli Arabs who participate in Israeli society, have their own institutions, their own schools. They have their own Sharia courts, in fact. And there's a lot of Sufi influence among them. It's more important for us in the Center for Islamic Pluralism to give a voice to these Israeli Arab figures that are not committed to Hamas, are not committed to Hezbollah, are not committed to an armed assault on the Israeli state, but are committed to developing a better position for themselves. And of course, they're not Zionists. They don't accept the Zionist doctrine. But they're not, at the same time, they're not going to leave Israel, and they're not, by and large, involved in violent resistance against Israel. They participate in Israeli institutions.
Yeah, and in some ways, that ultimately is going to, of necessity, be the accommodation that needs to be for.
I don't know if accommodation is the right word, but certainly they can be the basis of a solution.
Yeah. Well, actually, we've run out of time. I want to thank you, Stephen Schwartz. Again, his book is called The Other Islam, and it's available. It's published by Doubleday. And if you're interested in finding out more about Stephen Schwartz and the attempt to give a moderate Muslim Islam a much better a view, you can find his website, which is islamicpluralism.org. So that's islamicpluralism.org. You have been listening to Touchstones. I'm your host, Paul Naj, and thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.